I'm Dr. Yosefa Fogel-Rubel. This is a podcast episode brought to you by Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. Today's podcast is sponsored by Eli, David, and Judah Seidman in honor of their sister, Dr. Branya Levy, and in memory of Elisheva Yehudit Bat Branya Yocheved and Danielle Alexander. May her memory be a blessing. Sponsoring a podcast can be a meaningful way to mark any occasion. Write me at podcast@matan.org.il or check out the donation webpage on the Matan website, or you can contact them directly. Parshat Pekudei opens with a tally of medals, the sewing of the Kohen Gadol's special garments, and his breastpiece. The final product is brought to Moshe for inspection, just like God inspects his creations and declares them ready from the first chapter of the book of Bereshit. And then, like God, Moshe blesses the work just as God blessed the Sabbath. The completion of the Mishkan completes the entire act of creation. Moshe is then given instructions for an anointing process that is only completed in Parshat Shmini in the book of Vayikra, where we have the consecration of the tabernacle vessels, the altar, and the inauguration of the priests. But the building process and all its elements are completed here, just 2 weeks short of the one-year anniversary of the Exodus and 9 months since arriving at Sinai. When God's Shekhinah descends upon the Mishkan, enveloping it with a cloud of divine presence, we fully understand that the function of the Mishkan was to be a roving Sinai, wherein the people could communicate with God and feel the intensity of his providence. Today, I am honored to welcome a new guest, Rabbi Michael Hatton, director of the Beit Midrash for the Pardes Center for Jewish Educators and teacher of Tanakh and Halakha there. Michael is the author of Passages, Text and Transformation in the Parsha, as well as Joshua, The Challenge of the Promised Land, and Judges, The Perils of Possession. Rabbi Michael Hatton, it is a pleasure to have you here on the podcast. And today we're here to really speak about the figure of Bezalel, who he was, how he became part of our broader Masoret, of our tradition, and who he was in the Psukim, and also how his legacy really perpetuated in our tradition. So why don't you jump into the figure of Bezalel, wherever it feels right for you.
Thank you very much, Yosefa. Bezalel really is the central figure in the construction of the Mishkan. And we don't really know that much about his background in the Torah, at least. Chazal will construct a biography for him. I might begin just by noting that his grandfather is an individual by the name of Chur, Bezalel ben Uri ben Chur, and that he's descended from the tribe of Yehuda. In the Torah itself, we do hear about a character called Chur, who's mentioned on two occasions. One is the battle against Amalek in Parshat Bishalach, where Aharon and Hur support Moshe's hands. And the other is when Moshe ascends to Har Sinai to receive the Torah, the Luchot. So Moshe appoints Aharon and Hur as his lieutenants in his absence. So both of these sources indicate that Hur obviously was an important character in the story, although he's not really developed at any length in the Torah itself. So if Bezalel ben Uri ben Chur is in fact his grandson, that's pretty much all we know.
I mean, we also know that he's from the tribe of Yehuda, which I think is, you know, of course, they're the illustrious leaders of Am Yisrael. And so here we're learning about a different kind of leadership. And there aren't even so many instances of artistic leadership, but I'm sure we'll get to that later. But I think also just that lineage, also the connection to Hur, and also the connection to the tribe of Yehuda, is already sort of like this precursor of their leadership roles that are going to be, of course, much more dramatic and institutionalized later in Tanakh.
And of course, for Rashi and Chazal, that will be a contrast with Bezalel's helper, whose name is Aholiab ben Achisamach Lemateh Dan, who comes from perhaps the least illustrious tribe, the tribe of Dan. And Chazal will see in that some sort of an idea of the entire people of Israel being involved in this incredible project called the building of the Mishkan. Bezalel is first introduced in Parshat Ki Tisa to Moshe. Moshe will then introduce him to Bnei Yisrael in Parshat Vayakel. And in Parshat Pekudei, as the work of the Mishkan is wrapped up, he will be mentioned for the last time. Uvitzalel ben Uri ben Hur le Mate Yehuda asa et kol asher tziva Hashem et Moshe. Bezalel executed everything that God had commanded to Moshe, and Chazal will detect in that statement that Bezalel had some sort of an insight into the building of the Mishkan that even Moshe himself didn't have. So I want to explore Bezalel as a character, as an archetype. And in order to do so, I'd like to go back to Parshat Ki Tisa briefly and to consider the first introduction of this character. And it's rather unprecedented when Bezalel is introduced to Moshe. So the Torah tells us the following, Re'ei vayidaber Hashem el Moshe lemor. This is in Perek Lamed Aleph. God speaks to Moshe and he says, Re'ei karati v'shem Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur lemate Yehuda. Behold, I have called by name Bezalel ben Uri ben Hur of the tribe of Yehuda. And there isn't really another character in the Torah that's introduced in this way, being called by name, being designated, being singled out. It's a very, very unusual phrase. And the Ramban actually detects in it something incredible. But before I get to that, maybe I'll just go on a little bit, because Bezalel is described as being filled with Ruach Elohim, bechokhma, bitvuna, uvedaat, with knowledge, with wisdom, with understanding, uvechol melacha, lachshov machshavot, to do the work of textiles, to work with gold and silver and bronze, to work with stone, the malot, to work with precious stone, to work with wood, la'asot bechol melacha. So here we have a character who is introduced by name, and he has an unusual range of capabilities. And the Ramban really detects in this moment something very, very special. Ramban says the following. We know, I'll just paraphrase what the Ramban is saying. It's in Parshat Ki Tisa. He says that we know that in Egypt, Bnei Yisrael were not enrolled in the great academies of fine arts. They were involved in the work of brick and mortar. V'chol avodah basadeh, the Ramban calls it, avodat chomer ulevenim. And they certainly didn't learn any of the finer kinds of activities associated with working with precious metals. And not only did Bezalel work with precious metals, but he worked with a whole bunch of other materials as well. Ramban says it's highly unusual that we would find a character like this who couldn't possibly have been educated as a slave in Egypt. And the Ramban says, even if he were a natural, let's assume that Bezalel had some sort of a natural ability, innate ability, as some great artists sometimes do, that would not explain his ability to do the work right now, because, you know, I'm going to sort of update the Ramban's comment, but if you were to take a concert pianist and assign them a job in heavy construction, they will quickly lose their dexterity. So Bezalel wasn't educated, and even if he was a natural, it's hard to imagine that he could have held on to his skill. So where did it come from? And therefore, says the Ramban, Lachen amar Hashem l'Moshe shiyireh ha-pele hazeh, that the introduction of Bezalel is nothing short of miraculous. That's what it means to be designated by name by God. It's to be called from obscurity and to be inspired with some sort of an ability that he didn't have before. All in order to construct this building, this Mishkan. Ki haya ratzon milfanav la'asot ha-mishkan b'midbar. That was God's will. And therefore, Bezalel is created, as it were, in order to undertake that task, not that different from Yirmiyahu being summoned as a prophet from birth. So the Ramban basically says that Bezalel's introduction already indicates that we're dealing with somebody very, very unusual.
I think also something that is significant here, and it connects with the Midrash, it also says that Bezalel is somebody who was preordained from creation, right? It's reflecting a very similar idea, that there's a very careful dance in this whole construction of the Mishkan, between presenting it as a partnership with humans, right? It's a house that we built with God, right? To take from Rabbi Sacks, I believe, to really presenting that this is a divine structure. And it's being done through the hands of a human, but lest you think these are regular humans, right? Meaning it's sort of this very fine line between having it be a physical representation, but also wanting to make sure that this doesn't become too much of a physical project, right? If it just became, here's a really skilled person, built this nice building, and God comes, it almost assumes too much of a hand, I think, that human hands have here. And like all of these elements that are really here to help us understand how unbelievably unnatural these talents were, I think is part of this idea. It's not just elevating the mundane. It's saying that this is not mundane at all. And so I think that that's part of it, meaning his figure, there's something so mysterious and about him and something so unique. And it enforces this idea that this is not any kind of regular structure. And there's a partnership with humans, but it's not regular humans.
Okay, so, you know, if I were to expand on that a little bit, I would point out, as the commentaries do, that Bezalel's abilities are highly unusual. He is able to work with a range of materials that's unprecedented. You know, I've sort of asked, intentionally, I've asked many artists during the course of my life, if I were to give you, you know, let's say an artist presents themselves as a painter, and I say to them, all right, so here is a block of wood. Can you make something beautiful out of it? And the answer that I often receive is no, because my skills are in painting. They're not in sculpting wood. And if I were to give a carpenter a piece of gold and say, construct for me a beautiful piece of jewelry, they would say, I don't have that skill. My skills are in wood. And here we have a character that the Torah indicates is able to work with every material. He can work with textiles. He can work with precious metals. He can work with stone. He can work with wood. And everything that he does turns out perfectly. So what does that mean? I mean, you know, we've heard in human history of Renaissance people, Renaissance men, you know, coming from a background in architecture. So I'm thinking specifically of Michelangelo. Michelangelo was a gifted sculptor in marble. He did some work in wood. He was an architect. He was a painter. He only executed a couple of bronzes, and they were melted down to fight one of those Florentine wars, which leads me to believe maybe they weren't the most fantastic pieces of art. It's unusual to be able to work with everything. And yet that's the range of Bezalel's skills. Mm. That's the point of being called by name. And I want to go one step further. I'd like to suggest that Bezalel actually emerges as some sort of an archetype in the story. He represents something bigger than himself. And it's bound up with this introductory phrase, Va'amalei oto ruach Elohim, I filled him with the Spirit of God. That's a very unusual phrase, ruach Elohim. There's only two places in the Torah where it occurs. And the first one, I think all of us know, that's from the work of creation. Right? At the moment when creation is about to burst forth, everything is formless and void. V'ruach Elohim mirachefet al pnei hamayim. The Spirit of God hovered above the face of the deep, and God calls creation into being. Vayomer Elohim yihi or. And it's that kind of a moment. Basically, what I'd like to suggest, Yosefa, is that Bezalel is a creator.
I actually just wanted to read a really short quote from Leon Cass's commentary on Shmot, where I think he says something that really supports what you've been saying. He says, the true artist is God's divinely inspired co-creator, not a freelancer seeking fame for himself. The artists are God's prophets for the eyes. The beauty they cultivate becomes the skin of the good and the holy, and they help complete God's creation by producing for it the hallowed place where man and God may meet and know each other. I think that, again, this idea that he's part of creation, right? The supernatural element of Bezalel's virtuoso is in itself a mystery of creation. And so only somebody like him, together with God, through the instruction of Moshe, can create this kind of physical structure that's going to be a meeting place of heaven and earth. I think that's such an important and moving piece. I really never gave enough thought to the virtuoso that you're describing of Bezalel, so I really appreciate that idea.
Listen, you know, I think, Cass's quote is right on target. The way Chazal phrased it, Yodea haya Bezalel litzaref otiot shenivru'u bahen shamayim va'aretz. Mm-hmm. Bezalel knew how to join the letters by which heaven and earth were created. And Chazal go on to basically draw parallels between God's work of creation and Bezalel's work of creation. It's essentially a similar process. If I were to sort of trace the steps, I might say something like, Bezalel is charged with taking raw material, whether it's ore for extracting metal, whether it's wood, whether it's fibers for creating textile. Take that raw material, transform it into a finished product that has utility and or aesthetic value. And in between those two moments of the raw material at one end and the finished product of utility or aesthetic value at the other end is this spark of ingenuity, this intelligence, this wisdom, this understanding that guides the process and brings it to a successful completion. And that's essentially, in a nutshell, the work of creation. That's God creating the world. That's Bezalel creating the Mishkan. And as you pointed out correctly, those two things are somehow interconnected. The Mishkan as an expression of God's creation, writ small, so to speak, and Bezalel, therefore, as a creator figure. But, you know, I think that we have to note, as great as Bezalel is, he's a creator figure with a small c, which is to say God is a creator with a capital C, because God does creation of a sort that no human being can ever do. What Chazal called yesh me'ayin, creation ex nihilo, out of nothing. Bezalel can't do that. So he will begin with the material, the raw material, and he will work with that, and he will fashion that, but the process that he undergoes is going to be exactly the same as the process of creation. I'd like to suggest that's why he's called Bezalel. And his name has nothing to do with onions. Batzal, it's not about onions, obviously. It's about Bezalel. This man is in God's shadow. What does it mean to be in God's shadow? When we look at the shadow of an object, we see something of that object in it. It's a representation of it. It traces the contours of whatever it is a shadow of. It's not the thing itself, which might be much more grand, but it's absolutely connected to it and reminds us of it. And that's Bezalel. Bezalel labors in the shadow of God and is inspired with a divine ability that allows him to do the work of creation in miniature, call that the Mishkan. And therefore, to put all the pieces together, Ramban says, we require a special singling out and designation, because this man has inspiration that makes him unique as a creator figure.
This also represents, I think, a certain archetype, if maybe I'm taking it too far, but for what art and theory is supposed to do, right? Meaning not everything that's created in this world will be created in order to connect with God. But I think that it creates a model for, in theory, what art is supposed to do. I would even say, and this is not a field of expertise of mine, but I would say I'm dafka familiar with this more from Christian iconic art, meaning this idea that art is supposed to serve one's relationship with God. I feel that, of course, we have phenomenal artists in our tradition, but I guess I'm actually more familiar with sort of the breadth of that tradition as it's stretched over the centuries from the Christian world. But I think that there's a real model that's presented here. And I feel that the only person that really picked up on this idea and tried to broaden it and deepen it and say, yeah, art in general has potential to, you know, as we said before, to sort of be the the eyes or the prophet to a certain degree of God. It was really Rav Kook when he speaks about Bezalel and in the modern, you know, what was the pre-modern almost state of Israel. But this is what art has the potential to do. Now, that's not everybody's aspiration when they go out and create, but in theory, in a very, very elevated form, again, not everyone's going to be Bezalel, but art has the potential to create this kind of really spiritual connection, as you said beautifully, is a yesh meyesh, right? I mean, it's creating from materials that already exist. And I think it sort of puts out there this aspirational idea of what art in theory could be in the world, certainly religious art.
Absolutely. And there's no doubt that art has that ability to inspire us, I would say, because it's invested with some sort of a inspiration that's spiritual, that's intellectual, that's meaningful. I'd like to actually expand it a little bit and say that whatever Bezalel represents, he stands before God as a human being in the story. And whatever Bezalel is inspired with, it's true of all human beings. And I'd like to explore that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
The Torah describes him as being filled with chokhmah, tivunah, and da'at, which are terms that refer to our intellectual capacity, whether it means knowledge in the sense of information, and then perhaps making use of that knowledge, tivunah, and maybe it's wisdom, which is, you know, a more intuitive form of thinking. Whatever it is, Bezalel has that. And that's the conceptual or the abstract side of it, the design side of it, if you will. And at the same time, he can execute work with various materials, with the metals, with the wood, with the stone, with the textile. That's the practical side. And to be able to take these two things, the abstract thinking, the conceptual idea, and to then employ some kind of a skill, a concrete skill, in order to make that a reality. That's essentially what Bezalel does. I've sort of unpacked it, but the truth is that that's not particular to him. As human beings, those are precisely the kinds of capacities that we have and the kinds of capacities that we constantly employ in order to transform the world. That's essentially what we do. And to do that kind of work is to be a creator. To do that kind of work is to be in God's shadow. And I'd like to add one more critical word right now, which becomes actually the leitmotif of this entire story. When Bezalel is described as being inspired with intelligence and understanding, va'amaleo to ruach Elohim b'chokhmah b'tvunah uvedaat uvechol melacha, and with all manner of milacha, to work with textile, with gold, with silver, with bronze, v'charoshet even the malot v'charoshet etz, la'asot b'chol milacha. And so milacha actually comes up as the end of both of these lists. Whether it's the list of Bezalel's intellectual abilities, that's called kol milacha. Whether it's the list of Bezalel's practical skills, that's called la'asot b'chol melacha, which implies the active part of it. So maybe one more step in sort of understanding this process of who Bezalel is to recognize that the kind of activity that Bezalel does is a very particular kind of activity, and it's what we call in every other context, milacha.
I think what I'm just really getting from your description here, which again, I never thought about the division between the intellectual or, you know, cognitive, some sort of talent that is able to take these ideas and plan them versus the physical execution of them. I really never thought about the distinction between all of those ideas, is just that how many people in this world, as you said before, when it comes to the physical execution, how so many of us, we possess a very small part of one of those lists, meaning some people are great thinkers, some people are great executors, some people are good with materials, some people have great ideas but can't even touch materials. And again, it just keeps really, I'm really understanding, I think, for the first time fully, the genius that that is Bezalel, is that ability. So many people don't have the ability to connect between their perception in their minds and their actual execution in this world. And I think that that's really something that is so moving, because it's not a simple combination. They're different hemispheres, as we know today, of our brain, right? They're different kinds of perception. And I'll just bring in, because I feel like only through this conversation, I'm actually understanding the conversation that we had last week, where we spoke about the concept of Ru'u through the eyes of the Mashiloch. And he had said that this is calling upon Am Yisrael, like Bezalel, to learn how to possess another kind of perception, meaning look at Bezalel as an example. In your case, of how you're describing it, of somebody who's able to connect their thinking, planning, spatial abilities with their also ability to actually execute. And there he really spoke about the ability to see, right? To see things deeper. But it's also another kind of perception, meaning to look at Bezalel, it becomes this model of so many things, right? Of somebody who could see things differently, who can create almost, but not really like God does. And I think that it's, as you said, it's just beautiful human continuation of the creation story, where a person, a really, really unique kind of person, can possess abilities that are divine, or at least a refraction of the divine. And I don't know, I'm very moved by that. I really am appreciating also just that division of his skills. I never really thought about that.
What if I were to say to you that we all are Bezalel in some capacity? Sort of, I want to explore that idea, because as much as Bezalel is presented as a singularity, and I think you beautifully describe that, and it's undeniable, there's something about the work that he does that speaks to all of us as well. And I want to connect Bezalel with another phrase that we use in the creation story. And I'm actually wondering whether Bezalel is just, as it were, a short form for this longer phrase. Vayivra Elohim et ha'adam betzalmo, betzelem Elohim bara oto. To be created in tzelem Elohim is to be Bezalel. Mm-hmm. Tzelem and tzel are, of course, the same stem. It's the same root. And it's not just a matter of, you know, what I called before the shadow, but it's actually the image or the likeness. And whatever Bezalel represents in the story of the Mishkan, he also represents an idea that pertains to all of us. If I were to connect some of the dots, I might say the work that Bezalel does has a very particular name. It's never called Avodah. It's never called Pi'ula. It's never called Alila. It's never called Asiya, which are all wonderful synonyms for work. It's called melacha. And melacha is a very particular kind of activity. Melacha only comes up in two contexts for the most part. I did the math here. So did Chazal. There's about 60 times that the word melacha occurs in the Torah. 20 of those times have to do with the Mishkan, all the things that Bezalel and the other artisans prepare. 25 times. 25 times have to do with Shabbat and Yom Tov, which means 50 out of the 60 mentions of the term Melacha only come up in two kinds of contexts. The other 10 are neither here nor there. But that indicates that Melacha is a very, very particular kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I want to go back for a second. If you think about the work of Bnei Yisrael in Mitzrayim, at the beginning of Sefer Shemot, Vaya'avidu Bnei Yisrael et Mitzrayim befarech, Vaya'avidu, Vayamaru et chayehem ba'avodah kasha, bechomer uvilvenim, uvechol avodah basadeh, et kol avodatam asher avdu bahem befarech. It's all avodah, that's all they do is avodah, which is why they're avadim. Because an eved does avodah. Right, a slave does avodah, because avodah is about toil, and avodah is about drudgery, and avodah is about everything which is coarse and maybe necessary but unpleasant. And melacha is something else. if Avodah is about an Eved, Melacha is about a Malach. That's the root. It's not Melech, it's Malach, which is to say there's something refined, there's something divine about the ability to execute Melacha. It's a divine power. And it's a human power. It's a uniquely human ability. No other creature can do Melacha. So if we go back to the, you know, whatever, you know, through the course of our history in the Torah, there have been many definitions offered for what it means to be created B'Tzelem Elohim. Maybe it means intelligence, and maybe it means free will, and maybe it means language, and maybe it means abstract thinking, and maybe it means the moral capacity that we, and it means all of those things. I'd like to suggest when Tzelem Elohim is applied to the material world and transforms it, it's called Melacha. And that's a uniquely human capacity.
I think also another idea that comes up there is, I mean, sometimes we'll translate it as intentionality, but when I think of an Eved doing work, they're taking orders. So, you know, we do that a lot in life where we're just doing something sort of by rote, meaning that's what we have to do in the current moment. So it's a physical labor, but without the human using their internal creativity, without them using a sense of vision, because they're not allowed to use vision right now. That's not their function. And so when we sometimes translate melacha as being intentional work, I think it also doesn't do justice to what you're describing, meaning to do melacha, and of course, obviously we're dancing around the topic of Shabbat here, but to do melacha means to connect, as you said, between those cognitive, almost, you know, spiritual capabilities and our physical execution in this world. It's something, it's much more than just intentional, right? Somebody can intentionally put one brick on top of another, but it means that I'm utilizing my strengths inside my soul, inside my brain, in order to execute physically something in this world. And of course, I mean, I love that idea that we're all to a degree, we're all Bitzalel. But I think also it just sort of underscores how limiting that word intentional work is when sometimes it gets translated into English, because it's not really what I mean. Even creative work doesn't really describe, because then people will say, I don't know, what's creative about, like, you know, pouring my tea directly into my cup, right? Meaning that metaphor doesn't always work necessarily. But so there's something much more, much broader and deeper about what this kind of melacha represents.
So you know, I want to develop that a little bit. I think, you know, as you pointed out, we're sort of, you know, dancing around the idea of melacha and Shabbat. And of course, for Chazal, there was absolute overlap between the two, both in Parshat Vayakhel, as well as in Parshat Ki Tisa. Shabbat and the Mishkan are juxtaposed. And Chazal understood from that however we define the term melacha, it's going to draw its power from the work of the Mishkan. The kind of work that was done in the construction of the Mishkan will be defined as melacha in the master list of Hilchot Shabbat. And I think that's incredibly powerful. Because what it's saying is, yes, melacha is about intentionality, absolutely. There's no such thing as melacha without intentionality. Melechet machshevet asra Torah. But as much as it's about intentionality, it's also about the transformation of matter. Every melacha transforms matter. Maybe it's a small step in a much larger process, but it's transformative nonetheless. You know, Chazal constructed the list of Lamatet Melachot, the 39 activities that are defined as Melacha. They're spelled out in Perek Shivii, the 7th chapter of the Mishnah in Shabbat. And with your permission, I just want to spend a couple of minutes considering that list, because I think we sometimes get lost in the details and don't really appreciate what that list really speaks to. So we're not going to go through the whole thing. You know, Chazal basically helped us out by creating a list of 11 activities, the first 11 things on the list, which they called Sidura Depat, all the activities associated with creating a loaf of bread. You've got to plow, you've got to plant, you've got to harvest, and you've got to do this whole other range of activities until at the end of the day, you have a loaf of bread. And that's the first grouping. And the truth is, the rest of the things on that list of 39 activities, Yosefa, also can be grouped into larger units. There's a unit about using fibers to create material. There's a unit about interacting with other creatures, making use of them as byproducts for the work that we need to do. There's, of course, writing and erasing, and there's fire, and there's building and demolishing, and there's carrying, and that's basically the list. And if I were to take a step back from that list for a second and ask myself, what is this list actually about? And some people will say, well, you know, these are the things that we need for our daily living, which is true. These are the things that, you know, help us engage with the world, which is true. It's all true. But if we were for a second to consider that list as anthropologists or cultural historians, social historians, we would say this list is actually a fantastic summary of the revolutions in human history. The technological revolutions in human history are basically contained in this list. And one of the greatest was agriculture, which is what Chazal called Sidura Depat. We could talk about writing, we could talk about fire, we could talk about building, we could talk about using other creatures, we could talk about textiles. These are all things that change the course of human history, and they are uniquely human activities. No other creature can engage with these activities to any great degree. And if they can, it's a very, very limited amount of things that they can do. I know a spider can build a web, and that web is fantastically complex. And the fibers of the web, you know, scientists study that material, and it has greater tensile strength than steel and the rest of it, but a spider can only build a web. Mm-hmm. And the building that we do is a different order of magnitude, and so it is with all the other milachot, which is really a way of saying, milacha is a definition of what it is to be a human being inspired by God to transform the material world. And that is our unique capacity and ability. That's what it is to be Bezalel. That's what it means to do with the Avodah of the Mishkan, which is the world in miniature. However, you want to, I don't know if you want to interject.
No, I'm actually just dumbfounded by this. I'm deeply enjoying. Keep going.
Okay, so I want to say what I think is sort of a critical and sobering insight that emerges from this. Milacha is a double-edged sword. We are the only creatures on this planet that have this God-given ability to transform matter to the degree that we do. But that also gives us an incredible capacity to destroy the world, mm-hmm. if we so choose. I once, you know, as a young father, I saw lots of National Geographic videos with the kids. And I learned from a National Geographic video that the creature, besides human beings, that's able to transform nature to any great degree is the beaver. Believe it or not, the beaver builds a dam and redirects the flow of the water. So I'd like to share with our listeners, you know, beavers can build dams from now until the end of time. They will never succeed in destroying the world. They don't have that capacity. The capacity to be a creator means that if we don't exercise our ability thoughtfully and carefully, if we're not willing to put limits on our abilities, we will destroy the world. And I sometimes think that the essence of Shabbat is precisely that idea. Shabbat is not a celebration of milacha, it is, but it's actually a celebration of being able to cease from milacha. And if we don't have that capacity to step back and say enough, because we have been inspired with this creative power that makes us like God, we can destroy the world as well.
two thoughts come up. One is a commentary of Rav Hirsch on Shabbat, and he says that it's in his book Choriv. He says that one of the reasons why we have Shabbat is to remember that we, with all of our creative powers, are not actually responsible for the world continuing to be sustained, and that by taking a day off from our creation, we remember that ultimately God is the one who is upholding the world. Meaning the point of Shabbat is to actually put us back in our place. It connects to the sobering element I think you're speaking about, to put us back in our place and remind us that we ultimately are not the ones responsible for the fact that the world remains upright. And the other element I think that also is coming up for me when you bring in Dafka the sobering part, and I don't want it to overshadow the very empowering part and moving part about the beginning, is that
no pun intended.
Is that another, what'd you say?
No pun intended, yeah. To overshadow.
Yeah. Another story that of course comes up here is the story of Babel. That also is another example where we have human creation that gets out of hand. Now, it doesn't get out of hand, I think, because they're bringing the ends of the world, but it gets out of hand because they forget the image of God part, meaning they, and that I think is the depth of the Midrash that explains that they're actually waging war with God, which doesn't say to the Psukim, but I think that really is at the depth of things because they start creating before they've honed in on a lot of spiritual, I think, conceptual skills that hadn't been honed in on yet in the world. And so that's that big faux pas of that story. And so Bezalel comes as sort of like a very, very evolved, a changed version of that. I mean, I can build something tremendous, but it's completely devoid of the hubris and the conquest that the Tower of Babel possessed.
Beautifully put. You know, if I were to draw the direct connection, I would say, Migdal Bavel hava nilbana levenim v'nisrefa lisrefa, and Chaim Leibowitz points out is the first use of fire in the Torah officially, and that's basically pointing to this technological ability that's being developed.
Yeah.
And of course, when we talk about the Mishkan and Bezalel, Chazal will learn, Achad Shabbatotai tishmoru. Right, don't do melacha on Shabbat, the melacha of building the Mishkan. And of all the melachot that are singled out in the story of the Mishkan, we have fire. Lo tva'aru esh b'chol moshvotechem b'yom haShabbat, which is part of that juxtaposition with the Mishkan. So fire kind of appears in both stories and really highlights, as you said, the glaring contrast between the two.
Yeah.
One is a fire which is out of control, along with this human desire to usurp the place of God. And the other is this individual that labors humbly, as it were, in God's shadow and transforms the world in the most beautiful way. And that becomes the path to redemption, so to speak, the building of the Mishkan, the building of the Mikdash. There's just one other thing that I want to say. I don't know if it's critical or not, but I want to share that, you know, sort of what brought me to this insight a few years ago. And I woke with a start because, you know, I had sort of been under the mistaken impression that the nuclear weapons in the arsenals of the superpowers were fission weapons. I thought, okay, you know, fission, what's fission? You split the atom, it releases a tremendous amount of energy. How much damage can it do? Hiroshima, Nagasaki, I mean, that's big, but it's not the destruction of the whole world. Unfortunately, the nuclear weapons in the arsenals of the superpowers, for the most part, are not fission weapons. They're fusion weapons, which means that I take very light elements and I fuse them together. I take hydrogen atoms and I create helium, and that releases even more energy than fission, way more energy. It's actually the energy that powers the sun. The sun is powered by fusion reaction. So that, I stood back in amazement and realized that human beings have figured out how to harness the energy of the sun.
Wow.
And that's astounding. That's an astounding description of human ingenuity, human creativity, human ability. And I would say, at this point in human history, we need to be asking ourselves as human beings and as Jews, what are we going to do with this power? Because we really are at the tipping point. We can destroy the world if we choose to do so. Or we can preserve it and build a Mishkan. And unfortunately or fortunately, both of those abilities come from precisely the same source. It's because God has imbued us with Tzelem Elohim. And therefore, it's not a surprise that we have a Torah where the Torah always asks us to exercise self-control in whatever area of life that it is, and to recognize a higher purpose and a higher mission and a higher authority. And that when we can do that, we can take that ability, which is so unique and so profound, and use it to create something which is beautiful and useful and constructive and transformative, and ultimately brings us in connection, in proximity, in relationship, in encounter with the Creator Himself.
The only thing I'll add to that idea is that, of course, those projects reek of hubris, meaning those projects, the reason why they are destructive in the scary sense is because the ones that are spearheading or desire their use, meaning people can respond because they have to from a superpower, you know, geopolitical, for those reasons. But those who have, you know, spearheaded, it's much more a Migdal Bavil kind of creation than it is a Mishkan creation. So I think that that's part of what's so difficult about this topic. Rabbi Michael Hatton, I want to thank you for this conversation. It's been really breathtaking, and I am sure that our listeners will appreciate it as much as I have. So thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
We've reached the end of a book. Chazak, Chazak, Vinit Chazek. Learning Sefer Shmot was a real honor and pleasure to be learning with all of you. Each week, this series tried to study an element of the parasha refracted through the lens of a modern commentator. I left my comfort zone and spent several parashiyot engaged in Hasidic readings with new guests. We also focused on several biblical personalities, on Paro, Aharon, and Bezalel. And we met many new guests this season, and that was really enriching. I will also add that this podcast has been shifting alongside the war we are fighting. There were weeks when this podcast was hard for me to engage with, like much of my work, and I'm sure many can relate who are listening. I do feel that we have shifted back to a world with a little bit more breathing room, even though there are so many people still suffering, soldiers still losing their lives, and hostages still not home. I don't have anything brilliant to say other than that our prayers are with everyone who needs them. Our series on Vayikra will be repeating what I thought was a wonderful theme from last year, which is Kedusha is in the details. Each week, we will take one of the rather esoteric concepts in the book of Vayikra and try and mine them for their practical imports into our lives through the kind of thematic study we do here at the podcast. I'm really excited about these episodes, so stay tuned and remember to share these episodes with family and friends. Thanks for listening to this week's episode from Matan Women's Institute for Torah Study. If you would like to sponsor an episode, please contact the Matan office or email me at podcast@matan.org.il. Please do us and all women's Torah learning a favor and share this episode with all of your friends and family.